morning, good afternoon, good evening. My name is Parag. I am from Surat, the western part of India, and I'm really excited to be your co-host for today's Awaken Talk. Alongside with me is Audrey Lynn, who is from Berkeley, California. Welcome, and thank you all for joining us. Let us start with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves into this space, followed by a short prayer by Jamie. Thank you.
Kash Ganga, Surya Chandra Tara, Sandhya Usha, Koi Na Nathi. Akash Ganga, Surya Chandra Tara, Sandhya Usha, Koi Na Nathi. Kauni Bhumi, Kauni Nadi, Kauni Sagar Dhara, Ved Keval Shabd Amara Netamara. Akash Ganga, Surya Chandra Tara, Sandhya Usha, Koi Na Nathi. Ej Hasya, Ej Rudan, Asha E Nirasha, Ej Manava Urmi, Panabhin Bhasha. Akash Ganga, Surya Chandra Tara, Sandhya Usha, Koi Na Nathi. Megadhanu Andarna, Hoya Kadi Jango, Sundarta Kaj, Banya Vivid Rango. Akash Ganga, Surya Chandra Tara, Sandhya Usha, Koi Na Nathi. Sandhya Usha, Koi Na Nathi. Sandhya Usha, Koi Na Nathi.
Thank you, Jamit. Welcome everyone to today's Awaken Talk. Awaken Talk is a series of webinars to explore a wide array of compassionate response to our world today. We do that by holding conversation with inspiring guest speakers about their journeys in service and inner transformation.
Yeah, and today we're in conversation with Navin Amasurya on the boundless topic of finding contentment. So it's juicy. And as some background on Navin, as a child, he dreamed of being an animator. In his young adulthood, he cycled down the East Coast of the United States and in the country of East Timor. And then in adulthood, he became one of the fifth generation owners of a Singaporean luxury brand, BP Da Silva Group. And a few years ago, he left his formal operational role there to travel a bit on the uncharted territory of an inner path. And today, many know him as the Chief International Officer of the Contentment Foundation, which is an educational nonprofit that supports schools and communities in nurturing tools of well-being. But beyond kind of all these roles and definitions, I think what really strikes me about Navin is kind of this disarming quality of seeking truth that he embodies in the way that he shows up in the world and to the people around him. So Navin, thank you so much for joining us today. It's so great to have you here.
The feeling is mutual. And, you know, I told Parag and Audrey that even though there are a lot of people watching this talk, to me, even if this talk wasn't recorded, I'm so excited to talk to both of them because in their own right, they've really done a lot of work exploring the world within, and they live their lives in complete service as well, knowing the two of them personally. So thank you for talking to me for this time.
Nice try, but you can't throw it back to us. So before we begin, just a quick note to our listeners. The format of this 90-minute conversation is a moderated Q&A with Navin for the next hour or so. And then in our last third of the call, we'll invite questions from anyone who'd like to ask. So you can do that by submitting a comment or question in the webcast form on our live stream page. And you can also email us at askask@servicebase.org. And that will get to the powers that be that manifest the questions to us. And so, yeah, so to just dive right in, Navin, to begin, I think just to get a little background, it'd be great to kind of start in your childhood. And I think I know you wanted to become an animator as a kid. And I remember in a conversation we had, you said something about how you kind of always were holding these questions of wanting to understand life in a deeper way or in a kind of holistic way. You were kind of always asking for those questions that pushed a little more meaning. So I was wondering, could you share a little bit about your childhood? Like, what would you say has influenced you to kind of become the person you are today? Or are there any formative experiences that kind of stand out to you?
Sure. I was a kid that always loved stories. And when you think about stories, if I think about stories today, in a way, every organization we are part of, every spiritual tradition we ascribe to, every nation that we live in is simply a story which we believe by virtue of the different explorations or different stories we believe, we live in different worlds. So maybe intuitively from a young age, I was always drawn to stories and storytelling as a unifying force. And growing up, there's a very old newspaper article of me when I was maybe a couple of years old where this reporter was filming this preschool, and she saw me with the camera in my hand, and you know, I love photography and cameras for a long time in my life because photographs to me offered a window into a world, and you know, single photos can be extremely powerful as well. If you think of, you know, for example, the photo of you know, the young sailor kissing a person on the street in New York after World War II, or a photograph of the monk who set himself on fire in protest in the Vietnam War. These photos, you know, you can describe them in words, but they're really etched in memories. So this natural draw to storytelling was always there from a very young age. And I was super into science fiction. So for all of you people out there who love Star Wars and, you know, Lord of the Rings, you know, these intricately crafted worlds that you could lose yourself in. And in a way, stories were a way for me to escape as well. I lived a lot of my teenage life and early 20s in the view of escaping. And even the long distance bicycle rides or motorcycle rides I did were in a way escaping from an idea of thought of who I thought I had to be. Mm-hmm. So stories for me, you know, at a young age was about escape. But as I have gotten older, I realized stories are to be created. And the stories that we tell ourselves define our very lives. So it's very important for anyone to look at the story you tell yourself and decide how that story points to a North Star to a childhood of stories. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's beautiful. How did you switch from that view of story as kind of an escape or like a fantasy land to story as, you know, a very real thing that kind of defines creates our reality or our futures?
It's because when you really try and understand how things work, you realize that they're simply, particularly organizations, are simply a narrative that a leader can express that people connect to. And that's a very powerful skill that can be used for tremendous positive force in the world, but it can also be used to divide people. I think the time at which stories became very malleable for me so that I could bend stories was when I first started getting interested in meditation. And and actually it was a few years after I started, this was when I started doing longer retreats, where I started to realize that all of these stories that I was telling myself was simply stories. But the immense gravity of these stories is that even till today, there's some stories that I'm trapped in, that I can see I'm trapped in, but I'm still repeating these cycles and patterns. And when
and
I
you start, can see it.
yeah. And the power of them as well. And when I started working in my family business, because no one had really made an effort to combine the 150 years of our company in a single story, in kind of piecing together this story, I realized that historians actually shape the world, not history. Because in the end, maybe 50 years from now, if someone finds the work that I did, a lot of it was interpretation or extrapolation. And that saying that history is written by the victors is so true, because the people in power have an immense asynchronous ability to shape the narratives of what we in the world we live in. So even stories around money and wealth, in a way, the most popular stories are the ones that are shaped by the people most in power. So in a way, this unpacking of stories matters both at a very internal level, a very personal level, but also at a level of the systems you work in the wider world.
Wow. So there's a lot to unpack there. Yeah, Parag, go for it.
Yeah, a lot to unpack. And quite interesting to see how you look at stories and the narratives that you tend to work. Taking it forward, let us talk about the stories you talk to yourself about business and around that transition where you took the U-turn. So I was just wondering that you grow up in a family that runs Singapore, one of the Singapore's oldest family business, you know, BPD Silva Group, and one of the Singapore's premier luxury labels in a very affluent society. And you have boutique of luxury brands under your belt, and that's quite commanding in some sense. And after completing business school in UK, you returned to Singapore and spent 7 years immersed in operational role of that business. Well, you know, I had a one-to-one conversation with you, and I immediately felt that you are someone who lives a very examined life. Examined life means examining all your stories we tell to ourselves. So my question to that end is, how did you search for meaning and contentment influence your business work? And how did your business work influence your search for meaning and contentment?
We begin from the point of view that capitalism as an idea of political economy has become the predominant way we distribute resources around the world. And there is no other competing narrative that exists at this point. It's simply a tool. It's neither good nor evil. However, the nature of capitalism to concentrate in the hands of a few is something that we are starting to see the consequences of now. And being part of a group of companies that has been, you know, relatively successful thanks to my father's efforts and my ancestors' efforts over the last 150 years, I am a beneficiary of that in a very profound way. But at the same time, you realize that when you really look more deeply at the cost of operations of any company, they go below the surface of simply raw materials and labor. You know, these are line items that anyone who's familiar with accounting will have met. But there are externalities, there are unintended consequences of this concentration of capital that has existed, you know, since the beginning of capitalism, and even when you know, there were competing ideas of how resources should be distributed 100, 120 years ago. There were these criticisms that existed back then that never really were addressed. And, you know, the cost of it is a kind of debt. And the debt is that in some ways, the system mortgages our future for the present. In some ways, you know, how can I claim to be part of a multi-generational family business when in reality, due to the environmental impact of my operations, I am in a way contributing to increasing, you know, greenhouse gas emissions or depleting resource usage. Now, conventional argument that will always come back for many people when I share with them this is that, oh, you know, Nav, in the future, technology will be invented that would solve, you know, all of these issues. Or you can say that even now there's kind of a big shareholder revolt happening with oil companies where shareholders are demanding that they transition into renewables. So you can say, hey, you know, there's these positive changes happening. But I think if you study it more deeply, what you realize is that human beings have a tendency to magnify, cover up the gains in efficiency and productivity with more demand. So what I mean by that is, if you look at, even in Singapore, the poorest people in our society today will live better than kings 200 years ago. However, the human desire has increased ideally exponentially as well, conceivably exponentially as well. So the problem is that every time we make a technological improvement in, let's say, productivity, let's say a seamstress 100 years ago could produce 3 dresses a day. Now, today we have technology to make, let's say, 300 dresses a day. So does this mean that the seamstress can go home after a day's three dresses? It doesn't. It means that they have to produce 300, where before three was enough. And in a way, we'll always be chasing this tail. So unless we can really explore desire and explore the difference between needs and wants, we can't really harness the benefits of efficiency and of even better corporate social responsibility or even better resource usage, because if human greed rises in proportion or increases over our efficiency gains, then we'll always be chasing something that will never arrive at. So this intrinsically links to, you know, the psychology of contentment as well.
That's beautiful, quite insightful. The point about unintended consequences, and you know, without observing or understanding or exploring our desire, the efficiency cycle just go on chasing its own tail. That's quite insightful.
We're insatiable.
Just to ask one question, what was businessman Naveen like, and what was going on inside which eventually led you to step out of the business world? What was the that pivotal moment which, you know, took a U-turn in your life, if you can share something on that?
Businessman Nav was short hair. He didn't have a beard. He always wore a suit. Or not a suit, but I used to wear office clothes. He was someone who was self-medicating. So at the time I was a businessman, I really was passionate about car racing. So I used to race cars. It can be a very technical thing. And it was kind of, it's not an environmentally friendly sport at the slightest. And I always had a bit of a deeper kind of like self-reflection on it's something I should let go. So, and I think I the way I was able to cope with this dissonance or to try and block the clear seeing of what I was really doing in business was to ignore it and to cultivate a practice of ignorance. So it's kind of like the ostrich that puts the head in the sand. It thinks like nothing is going wrong, but you know, in reality, there are consequences to our actions as well. So I also didn't value my friends at the time. And I didn't value enough, self-cultivation. So all that changed. One of my many jobs, and you know, if you're a business owner, you probably know this, like there's no job title for a business owner. You do everything that's needed, all right? And one of the many jobs that I had to do was the subsidiary that I was running had a proprietary gold solution formula. So this is where we convert solid gold into liquid gold, and we use that gold for gold plating. So because the value of what we dealt with was so high, typically, you know, either the senior manager or myself would do it. So one day I was kind of going through the process of making this gold formula. And in order to break down gold, you need powerful chemicals. So even like the gold ring you're wearing or the gold earrings you have, in order to purify gold, you need chemicals like cyanide. And cyanide is a neurotoxin. So what that means is if it gets into your bloodstream, it affects the autonomous nervous system that you have, which is the nervous system that controls the automatic processes in your body, like your heartbeat or your breathing that happens automatically. And I spilled some on my hand because even though I had written the safety instructions for this process, instead of wearing arm-length gloves, I was wearing wrist-length gloves. So that's that was real hubris and stupidity on my part. And once I spilt it on my hand, I went to the chemical shower. The good thing is, because I wrote the safety procedure, I knew what to do. I caused the problem, but I knew how to. Well, anyway, so I went to the safety shower and used the chemicals to get it off. But I know that this chemistry can, if the concentration's high enough, it can go through the skin into the bloodstream. And then I have a certain amount of time before my heartbeat starts to be erratic and my breathing starts to be erratic. And then eventually I go into cardiac arrest and I die. So when I was in the hospital getting the blood test done on the concentration, I had this immense desire to go to a park, which was just next to the hospital. And so I walked down into the park, and as I was walking in the park, I was thinking, if this was my last day on earth, would I be happy with what I've done so far? And then I realized that answer was a very strong no. And despite the fact that, you know, the company had become more environmentally sustainable, the company had, you know, my family has always talked about the importance of employing people, but at the fundamental nature of the organization meant that in my mind, it couldn't be reconciled on the fact that we are in some ways mortgaging the future for the present. It led me to this really profound insight that I needed to leave, but I didn't know where to go. So a month later, it happened to be our group board meetings, and I submitted my resignation.
What a beautiful accident of cyanide, it seems.
Looking in and you didn't, you didn't die. You were okay.
That's the important part of the story.
Like, you didn't even get sick. You were okay.
I was okay. And I think one of the things I've been fortunate in my life is I've had a few near-death experiences. And I wouldn't encourage anyone to go seek them. But having a near-death experience is such a profound gift from the universe on what is really important. And in fact, in the Buddhist tradition, there's a particular meditation practice called Maranasati, which is called the mindfulness of death. And the reason why monks were instructed to cultivate this practice was that through really contemplating their death and really kind of watching that process, in a way, simulating what happened to me with the cyanide, just going through an object-oriented meditation, they then understand why life is so precious. And it then allows them to filter what is important and what is not. So, for example, there's a great book by a British nurse who was a nurse for 40 years, who wrote What the Dying Say. And she basically had a little journal where every time someone was on the deathbed, she would record what they say. And one line in that book kind of struck out to me. She says, at no point did anyone say they wish they gave more time at work. That's an interesting thought, right? Because if you think about what we prioritize day to day, how different is what we prioritize day to day relative to what is important to us when we're going to die? And the beauty of death and discussing death and exploring death is that it is the ultimate filter in which we can understand our own decisions.
One quick question, Naveen. As you say that people are, you know, I meet people, and I was one among them, who feel that they were trapped in a business setting. Either sometimes people are not able to see clearly, or most often it seems that they don't have enough courage to actually eject themselves or pull them out of it. So what would be your advice to take a near-death experience or maybe something else to really start seeing the trap they are in? You know, people who are in similar positions, not for all, but there are people who are in between on the cliff. Any advice for them?
There are different causes and conditions that arise in our lives. You know, for some people, they may have to support a family. For some people, they may have a mortgage of their parents' house they have to pay off. I don't get anything from my family business since I left. And that's fine, because, you know, I'm very happy to rent a room with my wife. And I'm very lucky to have a wife that is, I thought I was Spartan until I met her. And I think, aside from that, you know, aside from taking care of the needs, one thing to really, really question is, what is the difference between a need and a want? It's not an easy question to unpack, because I was talking to a friend recently in Singapore, and she spends a big part of her salary on additional lessons for tutoring for her kids. Because I work in the field of education, I was trying to explore whether this is a need or a want. From her perspective, all of the friends of the kids, her kids, all have this tutoring. So from her point of view, it's a need. I was just trying to introduce the idea to her that, you know, to maybe explore that a little bit more, because in Singapore last year, we had the highest rate of youth suicide in our history. Ooh. And it's actually been rising year on year. Now, in Asia, Singapore is one of the wealthiest countries per capita and in the world, not even in Asia. So why is there increasing mental affliction amongst all this wealth? Now, one point is that the wealth is not evenly distributed, which is correct, that the overall wealth is rising, but it's concentrated in the hands of a few. That's true. But at the same time, the government here has tried to kind of find different ways to distribute that wealth. So even then, you know, there's this phenomena that's arising. The value of what it means to be educated beyond linguistics, mathematics, and science, as I was trying to explain to this friend of mine, is that if her kids could learn about cultivating the muscle of attention, cultivating self-regulation. So how do we manage our desires? You know, should I eat the ice cream in the fridge, the whole thing today? Or can I like hold it off for a while? Or how do we learn about how to connect with people, pro-social behavior? And, you know, a lot of my personal life in business has shown that it's not so much what you know, it's who you know and how they see you. The question to ask is all this optimization for her kids' education really going to lead to flourishing adults? And I think there's a question mark on that. So again, from her perspective, it's a need. From my perspective, it could be more of a want. But this is up for an individual to decide.
There's so many questions I want to ask about that. So I do want to talk a bit more about your work in education. But I think before getting there, I kind of just to bridge from stepping out of the business world, I don't think you didn't really have a specific plan, you know, for what's next, right? Like you didn't die and then you left, you know, you submitted your resignation. And then it sounds like you just kind of jumped into uncharted waters in a way. So I'm just kind of curious in that field of not knowing, how did you determine what path you wanted to take? How did you even, you know, what was your compass to navigate that uncertainty?
I wouldn't recommend this, but there's an old Chinese anecdote about a general who was trying to invade a particular island province. And this general was aware that there had been three previous attempts to invade this island, but all of the attempts failed. So this general strategy was, okay, we'll do the plans to invade the island, but we'll make one change, which is when we invade the island, we'll burn the boats. Burning the boats meant that the soldiers who were on that island had only one way to go back home. And I think sometimes letting go is the way to learn. You know, if any of you ride a bicycle, when I first started riding a bicycle, I had training wheels, you know, the little wheels on the side of the bicycle. And, you know, for a long time, I really liked the training wheels. But a day came when my father actually took them off. And I remember that day because I kind of liked the training wheels. So why are you taking them off? It'd be so much harder to cycle the bike. But by taking them off, I fell down and I got injured for sure. But, you know, then 20 years later, I rode across a few continents on a bicycle, right? So unless you take that action to let go, you can remain imprisoned in the comfort of being numb. And I would add to that, the higher burn rate that you have in your life, the more difficult it is to let go. So what I mean by that is different people have different burn rates. For some people, if they go from a place to place, they need to take a cab. There's no way they will take a bus. For some people, if they go from place to place, it's only a bus. Maybe a cab if they can afford it, but it's only a bus. For others, they can go places to places just by walking. And with those three options, there are three different cost structures. For some people, they can only eat in restaurants. They can't cook at home. For other people, they never eat at restaurants. They only cook at home. So the way to kind of freedom, in a way that I've realized, having been in the luxury goods space, is actually trying to find ways to creatively reduce your wants. And it can be a game. So a lot of times people see renunciation as a dirty word, but renunciation simply means spending more time on things that really matter to you. An example would be when I stopped working for my family business, I realized I was eating out almost every day. And then I started to get interested in cooking, and now I can cook a meal that doesn't poison myself. So, you know, I've made a lot of progress. More than that, you know, I think there's beauty in a bit of discomfort sometimes. And if we can make a game out of trying to find how much lighter we can live, we have more flexibility into the choices we make. It's like, imagine climbing a mountain with a very heavy backpack. I mean, just you take a step and it's weighing you down. And now imagine taking out maybe a very thick book that you had in that bag. So now it's a bit lighter. You can go a few more steps. And then as you go, you take out maybe the big comforter that was in it. You take that out. And then you're walking a bit more comfortably. And the people that I've seen that are the most bold and the most introspective and the most giving are the ones who have a very light backpack. You know, some sadhus I know in India, and there's religious theologies that advocating not having a backpack at all. But my personal philosophy for lay people is that there's a fine line between asceticism that is completely challenging to live, as well as having the right amount. And the right amount changes depending on who you are and what you need. So consider that in almost every developed economy, economists will identify a dotted line, which they call the poverty line. So the poverty line in India will be different from Singapore, which will be different from the US. But no one ever identifies an abundance line. And if you don't identify the abundance line, then everything, we just become a victim of our endless desire. You know, Gandhi famously said, man has enough to satiate his needs, but not his greed. And I think that was extremely wise.
What's your abundance line? Or how would you define that? How would you chart that?
Yeah, so one really interesting psychological study that was published in 2007, it was a really famous study. So the numbers don't matter anymore, but the principle matters. It's by a Nobel Prize winning economist called Agnes Deaton. He basically, the goal of this research was to define what the abundance line was. So on the y-axis, on the vertical axis, he had a basket of indexes for quality of life. And on the x-axis, he had household income. And this study was done in the US. What he found in 2007, and again, the numbers don't matter because a lot has changed in the last 15 years. At the bottom index, the poverty line at the time, if I remember the number right, was $25,000. So for every dollar you earned, if you earn under $25,000, your quality of life was exponentially related, meaning that every dollar would give you, let's say, double the unit quality of life. Now, between $25,000 to $75,000, that was a one-to-one correlation, meaning that for every dollar you earn, you'll have one unit of quality of life increase. But once you hit $75,000, something fascinating happens. Any amount you earn beyond that has a more and more marginal increase, meaning that for every dollar you earn more than that, the amount of quality of life increase decreases. So it doesn't mean that if you earn $150,000, you'll be doubly as well or doubly as happy as the $75,000. If you earn $300,000, you know, you won't be quadruple. It doesn't work that way. The beauty about
non-linear.
So the beauty about finding what the abundance line is to you is that even having an abundance line already starts to reveal the nature of our desires, because naturally I still desire things beyond the abundance line, but I know what my abundance line is. So I was like, oh, that's nice, but I have this abundance line. So will I be doubly as happy with that thing? Unlikely. So It's not a very big challenge to let it go. And for me, also looking at your abundance line and creatively finding ways to reduce it is fun. It can be a game as well. Just like earning more is a game, you can have a game of life where you try to live on less.
Yeah. I feel like how did you like, was it ever difficult to kind of, you know, like you're still in the space of like, you know, I feel like in a business world or in even in a nonprofit world, in any world, right? Like when you have a certain structure and a certain impact or a certain profit, there's certain measurable things that help you know where you're, help you, give you the sense of solidity of where you are and where you fit into in the greater story. But for you, kind of navigating your kind of inner path, there's no solidity in an inner path. So I guess, like, what kinds of things kind of anchored you in your values or in, you know, or served as guideposts along your journey? Were there any people that kind of inspired you or situations or experiences?
You know, they say if you see beauty in anyone, you're probably looking at the light of their teachers. And if I'm anything at all, it's because I've been lucky to have incredible teachers along the way. I'd love to start with my grandmother, who was someone who I saw doing meditation when I was very young. And I remember going up to her and saying that, why are you sitting for so long? It seems stupid. And little did I know, you know, the path before me. But there's also someone who I talk about a lot, a guy called Matthew Ricard. He was a French geneticist who was working on Nobel Prize winning research when he went to the mountains of the Himalaya, and he became an anonymous Tibetan monk for 30 years. And when the Dalai Lama decided to create this dialogue between the scientific community and monastics, he was obviously, you know, very special because he was the bridge between contemplative practice and philosophy and the scientific world. Him, along with a guy called Richie Davidson, in the 2000s, published incredible research onto the power of scientific, of training the mind. They showed the efficacy of how the mind can be cultivated and the heart can be cultivated as well. And for me, I've never been a spiritual or religious person. Even till today, I wouldn't describe myself as that. But the way that they express these timeless and universal ideas through the lens of language of science is something that I resonated with so strongly. And when you start really diving into the research, you realize, again, all of these universal truths have been there for thousands of years. But in a way, they seem to get lost with time, and they kind of appear at different times. And you know, they're always there, but it's up to us to kind of seek them out and heed their work. And going even for this conversation, when I met Nipun Mehta for the first time, I was talking to my best friend back in Singapore. I said, hey, I met this guy. And I think he may be the walking embodiment of compassion, was my words. And I think all around us, there are people who float in and out of our lives that give us little windows of how we can be a little bit kinder and a little bit more wise. And it's true that everyone can be our teacher. It only requires a curiosity in virtue, whatever virtue means to you. One of the fundamental reasons why I think wisdom traditions are in a way sidelined compared to modern economy or progress is that we haven't considered that motivation can come from different places. So if you look at the world that we live in now, it's very extrinsically motivated. So, you know, how do I, if you're in the government, how do I increase the gross domestic product of my country so my people will have more? Or how do I get a pay rise next year? Or if I take on this more responsibility, can I get a higher title? Can I be on the board of a company? What if I change job? Will I get paid more? But all of these things are universal in that they're on the outside. And I think the beauty of contemplative practice, the beauty of spirituality, the beauty of religion, the beauty of science, I think in its pure form, is it comes from a place of childlike curiosity. And if we can kind of change the orientation or the energy of pursuit from one of trying to get something on the outside to gently looking at what already is inside and kind of playing with it like a little toy, life becomes really fun.
Well, I'm very intrigued by your practices around, you know, training or cultivating this mind. And I will have a couple of questions as we go forward. But before that, being a chief international officer for a nonprofit called Containment Foundation, you know, we would like to know more about how you get involved with that. You have been there for a couple of years now. Can you share your journey with them? You know, the internal motivation to be in Containment Foundation and the overarching domain where Containment Foundation works.
Sure. And just to share, you know, a lot of my friends from the business world find it funny that I moved from luxury to contentment.
So they ask, That's true.
Did you look for the thing furthest from what you did? You know, but in an odd way, I think I think the luxury goods industry taught me a lot. And what it taught me about was the importance of studying excess. So if on any level you are interested to pursue that excess, by all means, you know, it's a path that you probably need to go down to see for yourself. A great teacher of mine a few years ago said, if you want to know whether you should advance in a career or an industry, look at the people at the top of the industry, get to know them personally, and then see whether you want to be them. And again, going back to need and greed, it's very, very interesting to kind of explore the line of abundance. Now, I also want to say that one of the beautiful things about the luxury industry is that it does allow craft like jewelry making, goldsmithing, silversmithing, the arts way to be supported by people who have the money to support it. The challenge, of course, is that the luxury goods industry today, generally, in my view, is driven more by lifestyle rather than craft. So what it means is that it's not so much that I value this beautiful handbag because this family of workers has worked on it for three generations and they've perfected this kind of stitch that, you know, no one else can do. It's more that I want to be seen with this handbag. And, you know, the handbag is not the issue. The car is not the issue. The question is, what is our relationship to the thing? It's a bit of a nuanced point, but I think there can be healthier forms of consumption as well. So, and exploring that abundance line and exploring what truly gives you pleasure. You know, I'll just give you one example of this, what I think is a healthy way to consume luxury. There's a doctor in Singapore who has always loved nice cars. And in 1992, he saved up enough money to buy a Porsche. Like it's kind of like a race car that he bought, but you can drive it on the road. Switch to 2022, the Porsche Museum in Germany realized that the car that he bought was extremely valuable. And at the time, the company was losing money. They couldn't keep their car, so they had to sell the car to him. And they offered to buy it back for him for maybe 50 or 60 times what they sold it to him. So this guy has driven this car for 30 years, and now the brand museum wants to buy my car and put it in the museum. And he didn't sell it. So one day I saw him on the road, and I had to talk to him because I'm so curious, like, you know, why didn't you sell it? And he said, well, I like it for what it is. I don't think I need anything more. And there's no price that can replace that. So this is someone who I think has found a very healthy way to relate to what he owns. And so this idea of contentment is not ascetism. It's not you give up everything and live in the mountains. It's how we relate to what we have and see the beauty in what we have in more profound ways. So these are skills that can be cultivated. And when I left my family business, I was very lucky to have a friend who ran schools. And he said, look, Nav, I know you're not doing anything. I think he took pity on me and said, come work in my school for a while. And he gave me a contract to explore a project that he'd been passionate about, but he didn't have time to do, which was trying to explore social and emotional learning in schools. So they were a large school group with about 100 schools in Southeast Asia. And he practiced meditation. He was a big fan of positive psychology. He wanted more of his management team and his staff, the teachers, to embody this work. So in the process of looking at all of the social and emotional learning curriculums around the world, I found the Contentment Foundation, which I thought had a nice name, but I couldn't really understand what was different about it compared to the rest. And when I started to dive a bit deeper, I realized that the majority of their work dealt with adults. So all the curriculums out there tend to be developed for students, most curriculums. That's what a school is for, right? We have teachers that teach stuff to kids. But here was a organization that said, no, actually, cultivation of self-practice for the teachers is a prerequisite to anything you do with students. And from my own personal experience, it was evident that this was true. And when I met the team, I ended up volunteering for them for a while. And then when I left on another sabbatical, the CEO offered me a position. And, you know, I was very grateful. I mean, till today, I feel very grateful to be able to do this very meaningful work. And so maybe I'll just unpack the Contentment Foundation a bit for those of you who don't know. So schools traditionally, you know, all of us have been through kind of traditional academic education where we learn our times tables and we learn how to spell and we learn about science and physics and chemistry and all that. But the World Economic Forum has recently kind of done a report. It was published last year on skills of the future. And one of the big summaries of their work is that it's less and less important how much you know. It's more and more important how you react to change. So reacting to change is not something traditional education models do very well because it's linear in nature, meaning that you have a curriculum over a year that you train a child in. And then usually at the end of the year, you have an exam. And then based on the performance of the child in the exam, that's a measure of whether they are educated or not. But how does this really apply when you're working in a company and you're suddenly faced with a pandemic that's global and your supply chains have shut down and you know your rent needs to be paid and you need to kind of manage your cash flow? I mean, it's a totally different skill set. The truth is that because of the existential problems that are plaguing the world, change, the increasing speed of change is only more inevitable. So the way that you train children is first to start with the teachers. So we have a curriculum called the Four Pillars of Wellbeing. The first pillar is around attention and mindfulness. So for those of you who are not familiar, mindfulness is simply the cultivation of the muscle of attention and placing that attention in a relaxed way on an object for an extended period of time. And as you build this muscle more and more, you'll realize something interesting, at least I did. The most profitable companies in the world today are driven by distraction. So Google, Facebook, even snack companies. If I can distract you from long enough to consume my product, I'm a more successful company in terms of my shareholders. So people who are able to regulate their attention are simply able to make better long-term decisions for themselves and their family. And, you know, we may know this with a friend who gets too drunk too quickly, you know, and makes a fool of himself or hurts people. Or we may know this from people who impulse buy, you know, something shiny and then don't have enough money, you know, for the rest of the month. This is when you drill it down. It's a challenge of attention and being able to focus on attention on what matters. The next pillar is called community. So as we build the muscle of attention, we realize that there's a world inside us, emotional landscape that we can feel into. And we start to realize, oh, you know, I feel happy here, or I feel disappointed, I feel sad, or I feel like I really desire this object. And what's happening is you're watching the feeling. You're not in the feeling. And once you can do that in the community pillar, you can start to watch the feelings of others. So this is a prerequisite to empathy. If I can see the feelings inside myself, I can understand the feelings inside others. And usually people that are very cruel or who are very mean in real life have difficulty in understanding the feelings they are going through, or they don't have a complete ability to connect with that sense. So through cultivating this sense in themselves, they can start to understand how it impacts others as well. And of course, with empathy, we can start to cultivate compassion. And compassion is desire to alleviate one's suffering. So, you know, that you need empathy in order to be compassionate. And the third pillar is around self-curiosity. So as we kind of are dealing with this huge inner world that's inside us, we naturally start to realize that we are telling ourselves a story. And linking back to what I was talking about in the beginning, the story we tell ourselves shapes the world. And I know that there are politicians and there are businesses that frame conversations around other groups of people as other, and the in-group and the out-group, us versus the other. But the truth is that we are all connected. And if we understand our stories and we understand the narratives that we tell ourselves, we can see the narratives of others. And we can see that they are human beings just like us. And they are scared and they are fearful and they are happy just like us. So we can either grow collectively as a nation, we can either grow collectively as a human race, or we can all perish together. And the choice is ours. So that's the pillar of self-curiosity. And the final pillar, the pillar of contentment, is one that I personally feel balances all the other pillars. Because if we are always in the mindset of improving ourselves, we are never able to cultivate unconditional self-acceptance with who we are. And the analogy I really feel expresses this is a guitar string. If we are always in the point of view of self-improvement, the guitar string is too tight. And if we play the guitar, it snaps. If we just accept ourselves the way we are and never want to improve ourselves for anyone around us, the guitar string is too loose. You play the guitar, there's no sound. So life is this constant balance between self-improvement and unconditional love for oneself. And if you can find that harmony, you'll find the music to become very beautiful. And with unconditional self-acceptance, with cultivating contentment, the question then arises very naturally, which is, what can I give? So when you work out what the abundance line is for yourself, you may discover something amazing that actually you may have more than you need. And that creates a beautiful problem to have, which is, how do I use what I have to serve other people? And it's a very natural sequence of ideas that build on each other. And we work with teachers first. And once the teachers really understand this work, then we encourage them to share it with students. And we encourage this as a practice over a long time. The other important idea with any kind of work like this, whether it be positive psychology, contemplative practice, meditation, all of it, it's all about muscle building. And what that means is, you can't expect to go for one run this Sunday and expect to run a marathon or expect to be a good runner for the rest of your life. It doesn't work that way. And if there's one idea that I can leave you with, is cultivate curiosity and find ways to make yourself interested in this work. Because more than the work itself, if you're curious about it, that will give you the endurance to practice this work for a lifetime. And through the lifetime of practice is where the benefits will come as a byproduct.
Wow. It sounds like you really have a long view. A question that I love that we often ask is, you know, instead of what's your 5-year plan? It's like, what is your 5,000 year plan? And I feel like you just articulated that. I remember in a previous conversation, one thing that struck me when you're talking about your work with the Contentment Foundation is that when you work with schools or when you work with teachers, you don't just kind of do a teacher training workshop and, you know, and then say, here's the curriculum, let us know how we can help, right? Like, it doesn't end there. You really kind of nurture the garden of this ecology of education. And I'm just curious if you could speak a little to that and, you know, what is kind of the thinking behind that and how do you actually go ahead and implement in a way of kind of sowing seeds and not being sure what seeds will take root, but, you know, operating in that way.
Sure. And there's a great amount of research into how habits can be changed. And really what we're trying to do here is to help encourage positive habits. I can't remember the name of the psychologist whose, I guess, whole academic career is based on habits, but he had a really great story of how he wanted to make himself fitter. And he could never do push-ups well. He basically, what he did was, in order to create habits, you have to find places at which there's very low resistance to practice. And so every time he would have a shower, right after the shower, he would do one push-up, just one push-up. You know, not difficult. We can all go for a shower and do a push-up. And kind of a couple of years later, he's doing, I think, about 200 or 100 push-ups a day or something, because one push-up was too easy. So now he does like 25 or 30 at a shot. And you know, I guess he has a lot of showers, but, you know, he... So in the same way, when we work with schools, we try to kind of identify what schools are already doing. Now, the most simple practice, and if any of you here are teachers, is before you start a class, take 30 seconds for everyone to be quiet. And 30 seconds is not a lot of time, right? And just like allow the kids and yourself to arrive. You can close your eyes if you like. You can look at a tree or some nature out the window if it's there. And over time, this becomes habitual, where people start to enter these rooms or even have meetings where they're quiet for a while. This person was trying to explain the importance of silence. And he said, if you change the ordering of the letters of silent, you actually can make listen.
Oh, so, yeah.
So silence is a prerequisite to listening.
Listen.
And so with this anagram, if you think about silence and its relationship to listening, it's very profound, because even the act of, in a way, being silent with your students is they are feeling more heard by you as a teacher. So again, it doesn't have to be, you know, world changing. You don't have to climb a mountain and find a sage in a cave. You know, all you have to do is just, you know, be quiet for a little while. So in the same way, what we encourage schools to do is find little gaps in the day where you can practice things like empathy, like compassion, like silence and mindfulness, and over time the muscle will grow.
That's beautiful, amazing. It is profound, but you know, packed in a very small packages, you know, throughout the day and throughout the week and throughout the month to build that muscle. Amazing. But just thinking of habits and, you know, small ways to change it, I'm just curious. Maybe I'm a little wondering, what would you like to change in your daily life? One routine which is a little hard to change, you know, you find it difficult to accomplish, or you have accomplished, you know, very easily. What was difficult at one point of time?
Oh, that's so easy because I'm working on it right now. I have a very bad habit of using my phone at night. And I want to actually stop using my phone after 9 p.m. And I track the days that I do it, where I don't use it after 9 p.m. And it's actually very low, because at the end of the day, sometimes I have late calls with American schools. And after I have a call, I kind of like to unwind by watching a screen. And it's a habit that I've built up over, I think, a lifetime. So that is the habit that I'm trying to reprogram at the moment. And another thing as well is habits take a long time to change. And I think tracking habits is kind of very simple to do in an age of smartphones, where I have a little app where it just counts the habits. So every year I pick a few habits, either I want to cultivate or I want to let go of. And then I just put dots, and just every month I tally up the dots. And, you know, just looking at the dots, I'm like, ah, yes, maybe I have to like put my phone outside or and all that. And again, I'm balancing it with accepting myself as I am, because the Contentment Foundation is going through incredible growth right now. And honestly, like, I work every day of the week, and this is the way I unwind. So I'm still trying to find a skillful way of letting that go, but it is my aspiration to let go.
And quickly, any habit you have accomplished through this?
Exercise and learning Japanese. So my wife is Japanese, and my parents-in-law don't speak English, or they're learning English, like I'm learning Japanese. So yeah, it's, you know, every day at least 15 minutes of Japanese. So if, let's say, I do it for 300 days in a year, 300 divided by 4, it's 75 hours of Japanese in a year, just doing 15 minutes a day, right? So 75 hours in a year, 750 hours in 10 years, you know, it all adds up over time.
Beautiful.
That's great. I think we have a few questions in the queue here. But one of the questions that came up here from Sonal is kind of looking at, in the business realm, what's your perspective on the logic that businesses can take advantage of the profitable opportunities they have been given and then give back the profits to the community?
I think it's what a lot of businesses are doing now. But I think the challenge comes when, in a way, the profits are being built on externalities that are not being covered. So one easy example to express this is kind of like oil companies. So for many years, different companies had CSR initiatives, mainly to build better community relationships. But the fundamental premise of their business was to try and make a comfortable operating environment for an oil-based economy, right? So what is the challenge there? And I think more than businesses giving back profit to society, the companies that I tend to respect more are companies that actively advocate for better standards and practices, both from regulatory rules that governments put in place or through industry-wide initiatives to improve standards in their respective industries. One company like that is Patagonia, based out of California, who has, again, advocated for supply chain transparency. They've walked the talk. They've actually kind of made their supply chain completely transparent. And, you know, they lobby governments not to reduce their taxation or reduce their costs. They lobby to, in fact, increase it for the good of society. So a little skeptical of companies that only give away money. I think it could come from a good place, but at the same time, is it solving systemic issues? Would be my question. Or is it done to further tax breaks, or is it done to get build non-financial goodwill? You know, sometimes even when I was in business, you could see managers kind of suggesting that we give a gift to this particular person or that particular person to build relationships. And, you know, at the end, you have to question what is the intention behind giving away this money.
Right. Yeah. Bringing it back to the motivations. We have a few more, a few similar questions here. One is Rishabh from India wrote, is there a destination, kind of on your personal journey, is there a destination to this journey? Is there anything that you're still seeking but eludes you? And kind of on a similar vein, another Sonal asked, can you share one or two aha moments from your journey?
The destination is right here. I mean, this is the only real destination there is, right? The future is a dream, the past is already gone. So what else is there but here? Either while we're here, we can choose to fight where we are, or we can try and change the way we see where we are. There's a lot that could be seen as in our control and a lot not in our control, but more and more my personal philosophy is leaning more towards that there's less, we have less control than we think in life. So the only real way we can dance with life is to change the way we subjectively experience where we are right now. So I'm very happy to be here, by the way, just if that wasn't clear, super happy. Like, I love talking to Parag and Audrey. For the next question on aha moments, I have a really close friend who used to be a Zen monk. And one of the things that he taught me was the reason why philosophies have branched out over history. And you can think about it from Abrahamic religions, where there's Judaism, Islam, Christianity, or even like, you know, Buddhism spread into like Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, and of course the galaxy of ancient Indian wisdom and all over the world, is because they're different people with different tendencies that respond to different ways of a problem or an idea being expressed. The aha moments arose in my life when I had a teacher that could explain universal wisdom in a way I could understand it. I think it's a combination of seeking teachers as well as allowing teachers to arise and always staying curious to people who are wiser than you, and to try and capture the wisdom of people who are much older and who really have done a lot of self-work. Mm. So as a general principle, if you can find a teacher whose ideas resonate with you and whose ideas you test and they seem to hold true, then it can be a very powerful force in life.
Mm. You mentioned, that just makes me think, you mentioned something about how you're not a religious person or you don't really have a religion, but it sounds like you've explored a lot of different teachings. Can you kind of just share a little bit about your journey with that?
Yeah, sure. I think I may have shared this on the last talk. I can't remember now, but there's a poem that actually influences my thinking a lot with this question. And it's an old Japanese poem called The Monkey Points at the Moon. So the monkey is pointing at the moon, grasping to a branch, and he's pointing very vigorously. But the author of the poem writes, if only the monkey would let go of the branch, he would end up falling into the dark pool of water and realize the moon was above him all along. So it's this idea that all written language, all ideas that are expressed, even the ones that you are hearing coming out of my mouth now, are approximations to what truth is. If 100 people see this, there could be 100 different perspectives into what they think I think is true. And the only way to experience this truth is to actually let go of the branch. And this is the importance of cultivating practices within some of these spiritual lineages. You know, when I was young, my grandma used to bring me to the temple, same grandma, and I used to have to walk around a tree and give offerings. And I really didn't like it because I didn't understand, what does this all mean? I'm chanting in a language I don't know, and I'm putting flowers here. Like, can you, someone tell me what's going on? And I never really got a good explanation of why that was. But now I understand that in a way, this chanting, these flowers, they're simply just training our minds and orienting it towards virtue, right? And if you can kind of see it that way, then in a way, it's a neuro-linguistic programming of the mind. So like the monkeys letting go of the branch, if we can let go of the ideas of our own lineages and really try and dive into the teachings as deeply as we can, a beautiful thing happens. There is no division between these teachings. And in a way, it's more of what you see. You know, what is the beauty in Islam that arises for you? What is the beauty in Christianity that arises with you? What is the beauty of the Bhagavad Gita? What is the beauty of Lao Tzu and the Tao Te Ching? What is the beauty of Seneca and Stoicism? what is the beauty of, you know, Aristotle's work? And you realize all of these wise people out of history are singing the same song. And you can start to listen to a chorus of music that comes together that, to me, is really beautiful.
There's a lot of questions coming in now. I'm like, which one do we ask? But kind of, okay, on this topic of, I guess, like universal wisdom, love is, in a way, a universal wisdom. And someone wrote in asking, what has been the role of love and deep relationships in your activism work now? It's not an easy practice to generate love for someone and be patient, even if you don't agree with the actions or their conduct. So how do you kind of cultivate, a sense of selfless love in the work that you do, in the impact, so to speak, that you want to make?
I think it's really important. And, you know, this question, and whoever asked it, thank you so much for bringing it up. I think it's important to unpack an idea that I think is universal, but is false. And that's the idea of survival of the fittest. So you may have heard this term before. You may have even heard people attribute it to Darwin. He never said such a thing. In The Origin of Species, which was a book on evolution that changed the world, he had a whole chapter dedicated to how, even though human beings were never the strongest, they were never the fastest, because they could communicate with each other in very primitive ways, and because, importantly, they cared for each other, they were able to build on ideas and work that could transcend generations. So a baboon or a chimpanzee can only serve its current generation. Once it dies, there's nothing the next generation inherits. But human beings have this ability that we can build on what was done in the past. And if you boil down the single reason that humanity has thrived, I don't feel that it's conflict. I don't feel that it was motivated because of resource acquisition. I feel that it was because of love, and because generations of people planted trees whose shade they never sat in. And the role of cultivation of love, at least in my personal journey, starts actually with cultivating love for oneself. And it's not an easy practice to do, because when I first heard about this idea, I thought it was a bit narcissistic. I thought it was like, isn't this really self-serving? Like, why should I love myself? But loving yourself is a prerequisite for unconditional self-acceptance. And in a way, if there's something, well, I've noticed for myself, if there's something I can't accept about someone else, it's usually because I can't accept that same quality in myself. And that is still there. I think this is a lifetime of work that I need to go through. But again, it shows the importance with kids and education. I always thought to myself that if I learned these ideas a bit younger, there would be less heavy lifting to undo what I learned as a child that contributed to this misguided thinking. So love is the force that moves humanity. And love is not only a given, it needs to be cultivated, even in the way that we see and the way that we do. So there are many different practices of love you can explore in the psychological and wisdom traditions, but I'd encourage keep practicing.
So we have a few kind of questions in the educational sphere, and just looking at the time, maybe I'll ask three questions and then you can kind of pick which one. Does that work okay?
Yeah, I'll try to keep the answer short. Sorry.
No, it's beautiful. There's no, time is relative, right? So, but I just want to try to fit them in if it aligns. So somebody anonymous asked, in your work with the Contentment Foundation, what's the time frame as far as working with teachers is concerned? And is there a journey in the lifetime of the school when well-being practices should be prioritized? Or maybe we can just do one at a time so that
you have
immediate thoughts. Yeah.
First question is, we have about 5 coaching calls with the school. There's a set of pre-self-directed learning you do before that. So you can actually learn the tools in about 6 to 8 weeks. But what we always say is that you can't think of this as an 8-week program where it ends. 8 weeks is when the beginning of the practice starts. And typically we see schools take about 1 to 2 years to really kind of root this work in their schools.
Another question is, I volunteer with an alternative learning space in a village in Gujarat in India. How do we create an environment for understanding contentment and the abundance line as a way of life in a place where children come from economically vulnerable backgrounds? And the narrative they're constantly fed, thanks to the television and internet, is that money is the only redeemer.
Money is an important force in the world, but the heedless pursuit of money can be destructive. And I think to balance what the beauty they see with money, it's also important to balance the opposing force as well. It's sort of like what would the people in pursuit of money cause immense amounts of suffering as well. And I think probably the best thing you can do to support kids as well is to give them a total view. And I really hope, you know, that the circumstances in life improve. We all want that. But just like we were talking about the abundance line, maybe to also show the dark side of a heedless pursuit of money, which comes at the cost sometimes of families, societies, has to also be discussed in order for kids to make a balanced decision on what they want to do.
But yeah, that's great. Thank you. That's a good question. And then another kind of the last one around education is a little bit around curriculum. So it's basically wouldn't a standardized formal way of teaching virtues have the same repercussions as the formal education and chasing numeracy literacy has done? So like, how do you even begin to think about creating a standardized curriculum for virtues and not kind of just fall down the same trap of the same system, basically?
It's a brilliant question, and one that we ask ourselves at the foundation every day. As we scale, when we were working with less schools, this wasn't so much of an issue because we had more time to get to know people and really practice with them more deeply. But as we grow, this is a challenge that we are facing. One idea that I've found personally very powerful is the difference between intellectual understanding and experiential understanding, and they're very different. To use the example of riding a bicycle, you could come for an 8-week course in riding a bicycle. I could teach you about metals. I could teach you about physics. I could teach you about, human physiology. But if you never rode the bicycle for 8 weeks, when you graduate and get your certificate, you get on the bike and you fall down. Conversely, if you spend the 8 weeks balancing on the bicycle, trying your best to kind of find your flow, over time, you'd learn how to ride the bicycle. And after 8 weeks without the certificate, you would still be able to ride the bicycle. So we are trying to make this work as experiential as possible. And it's an excellent question. And I could unpack that further. But for those of you that have to go, I just want to share my email address with you. If you have any specific questions, like, I'll do my best to answer them. So my email is Navin, that's N-A-V-I-N, at contentment.org.
Thank you. I have so many more questions. Maybe I'll ask one more question just for fun, and then I'll go to Paraguay to ask our final question, and then take us into a minute of silence to close. And then we actually have a little surprise for you. Hopefully we can squeeze that into the next 5 minutes. But my last question is, you mentioned earlier in the call that you've had a few near-death experiences. So, what were some of your other near-death experiences, or what was? I know this is not like a soundbite question, but what was maybe another one of your near-death experiences, or what did you kind of learn from that?
There were two. There was one which was a car crash when I was 16, and then there was another one which was a motorcycle crash when I was 26. And then this cyanide thing happened when I was, I think, 29, 30. So every 5 years, I seem to have...
It is you now.
Oh, 5-year mark now. I better buy insurance.
Thank you. You know, we are coming closer to our end time. So one quick but question from our heart, how service-based ecosystem community can serve you, support you, your journey, contentment in any way? We would be more than happy to serve if you can share some.
You know, I feel very grateful to receive such an offer. It's kind of ironic that, you know, I run operations for the Contentment Foundation in these 8 countries and we're growing and all that. But in my heart, I know that in a way I do the work that I can and the rest is not up to me. So the best thing that all of you could offer me is if you discover practices that you resonate with and spend time and energy to cultivate them, and to try and contribute to building a community of people to cultivate together, which is everything that you're already doing. So I would kind of amplify that in any way that I could, because that's where the work is. We can only change ourselves.
Thank you. Super.
Yeah, no, thank you, Navin. It's such a treat to have this conversation with you and to just soak in your presence. It's so genuine. So maybe we'll just close with a minute of silence in gratitude for just the opportunity to share space in this way, to dialogue around contentment and to just soak it all in. And may the merits of this conversation, if there were any, and I feel like there were some, may they not stay with us, but may they just, reach out wherever they need to go. So we'll just have a minute of silence. Thank you. Thank you, Navin. Thank you, Paragvai. Thank you, everybody.
Amazing. Thank you so much, everyone.
So on behalf of everybody, thank you so much, Navin.
No, not at all. It's a pleasure. And like I said, before this conversation started, I asked the team, what dreams do they have? And I wanted to echo that if there's anything I can help you to get to your dream, please just email me at navin@contentment.org with your dream, and I'll do everything in my power to help support you in your journey to get there.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.